You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 16th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Nakanian, founding editor of the Appeal Political Report. Some of those down ballot races in referendums we had talked about before the election, how did they end up? And then later in the second half of the program, Paul Rykoff will be joining us for a little debate on exactly what went wrong some of those congressional races. Meanwhile, we're number one, folks. U.S. sees 1 million new COVID cases in less than a week as infections rage across the country. The upper Midwest, they're being defiant. Not going to take any measures to stop it. Team Trump's legal challenges, meanwhile, crumble as he almost admits he's lost the election. Good news on the vaccine front. Moderna reports its vaccine may have a 95% effectiveness. And it's easier to deliver than the Pfizer one. No relation, David Perdue chickens out of an Ossoff debate in the Georgia runoff. Trump's weekend rallies turned violent, three stabbings in D.C. while he, of course, hits the golf course. The Minnesota Republican state lawmakers sent alert of their COVID infections only to their side of the aisle. Federal judge rules that the acting DHS appointment is illegal and says Chad Wolf has no authority to suspend DACA. And lastly, Trump's plan to deny Social Security disability claims set to go into effect by the end of the year. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. We're very excited to have you with us. Don't forget, if you miss any part of this show, you can check it out on the Peacock app, the Choice channel. All you got to do, you can go into the Peacock app. You can just search for the Majority Report. That'll take you to the archived versions of the show and to the Choice channel. You can check out they have like dayside programming. Then in the evening, you can see Mehdi Hassan's show and Zerlina Maxwell's show. And our show plays 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. And then I guess like maybe in the middle of the night, if you're awake for it. But in the meantime, we also have some news. I want to welcome to the program. She's been here. She's been like hanging around the office a little bit.
Yeah.
Officially, I want to welcome Emma Viglin to the show. Emma's going to be riding shotgun in this first hour of the program. Emma, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. We're here in studio, separated by our plexiglass dividers, so we don't infect one another. We're being very safe here.
Very kind of you to call it plexiglass. It's actually a shower curtain that I set up, but nevertheless,
I was trying to make us sound fancier than we are.
I know.
Yeah.
But it is nice to be in studio with someone, and we have, we should just tell people we have humidifiers, and we have air purifier, and we got the window open, so I'm going to be back into sweater vest mode a little bit quicker than I normally would be. And I know that causes consternation amongst other folks out there whose names will go unnamed. But, you know, some people don't think it's terribly stylish to wear a sweater vest, but I like it.
Huh. Yep. Well, I mean, if you own it, then it's your trademark, and then it becomes stylish once again.
It's very northeast of you, Sam.
Yes, it is. It is. It's very northeast of me. And it's also, I mean, sadly, my...
It's very Rick Santorum of you.
I know it, but I got news for you. I was wearing that thing back in high school before Rick Santorum was just a twinkle.
He stole
it from you. Exactly. Yeah. He adopted it.
Fellow Northeasterner himself, unfortunately.
Yes, I know.
Is that what that doesn't count? Or maybe
Pennsylvania?
No. No, it doesn't count.
Folks, we are in the midst of a really bad situation with COVID across the country. There are 11 million cases of COVID-19 being reported in the United States. Hospitalizations are now topping, well over 65,000. I think we're close to 70,000. It's going back and forth a little bit. On Friday, there were 184,000 new confirmed cases. Over the weekend, some of the data gets a little hinky, so it's tough things better to rely on, like what's happening on Monday or Friday. There were 1,400 deaths on Friday. I mean, it feels like it was less than a month, and it probably was, where we were just saying new cases were in the 80,000s. And like I say, we recorded 1 million new cases in a little bit under a week. Deaths, there were 620 new deaths reported on Sunday. Again, that is the Sunday reportings are lower, but that is the highest death rate on a Sunday reported since May 17.
Right, and it should be noted that in terms of hospitalization rates, Hispanic and Latino people, over four times the rate of white people. Black Americans, it's around 3.9 times higher. So this is disproportionately affecting people who are more likely to be working in industries like the food service industry, healthcare, things like that, essential workers, and it's just getting worse and worse over time.
And to some extent, I should not say to some extent, to the extent that we have any good data on this and any good science, the more you're exposed in a given moment, the worse the infection actually can be.
Right, which is so different than other diseases. I mean, it's really remarkable in that.
It's not binary.
Exactly.
And so, you know, we are facing sort of the worst of all worlds in terms of this surge happening. It's not necessarily coincidental, but people are going inside more generally. The air is drier and colder, and so the efficacy, I guess, if you could call it, of the disease to infect other people goes up. And of course, we're right in on the front end of the holiday season, so people are going to go inside more with other people who are coming from other places. And I guess the fourth element is we have an administration that is completely out to lunch. Completely out to lunch on this.
Well, and then now that he's lost the election and is sort of acknowledging that fact, it gives him even less of an incentive to take it seriously because he doesn't take anything. I mean, it was the same thing with why you and I both argued that Pelosi should have accepted Mnuchin's package before the election, because now that Trump's lost, there's zero chance that a stimulus is coming at all or at the earliest in February.
Yes. I mean, I can't imagine any other scenario.
As cases surge and deaths surge and the economy gets even more in dire straits.
There is good news about vaccines. However, I mean, under any circumstance, we're not the vaccine is not going to become terribly relevant until early spring in the best case scenario. Moderna. And remember last week we heard from Pfizer and its partner BioNTech had a vaccine that was considered to be more than 90% effective, right? And there's obviously got to be more study on this, but Moderna's vaccine, which is co-developed with Anthony Fauci's institute, is being tested in 30,000 people. Half received two doses of the vaccine, half received placebo. And what happens is they vaccinate 30,000 people. They let them live their lives. And they see statistically, you know, the likelihood of people getting the placebo and getting the vaccine. Theoretically, if the vaccine doesn't work, there should be more or less the same amount of people who catch COVID, whether they got the placebo or the vaccination. Of the 95 cases of COVID-19 amongst these 30,000 people so far, the disease, 90 of those 95 were in the placebo group. There were 11 severe cases, and all of those people received placebo. So the five people who did get it with the vaccine did not get the severe cases. Now, here's how this works. You need to have a certain statistic that needs to be hit to move to the next stage of emergency use authorization. You need to have 150 cases. So you need to basically have a third more cases than they've already had amongst this 30,000 people to get a statistical notion of how effective it is. They presumed that they would not get 150 cases until early next year, January, maybe February, because of the rate in which people catch COVID. If you have 30,000 people, you can expect only 150 cases over a certain period of time. Well, because the country is basically on fire with COVID, they anticipate hitting that next third of infected people within 7 to 10 days. They are months ahead of schedule because COVID has increased, the infection rate in this country has increased that much faster.
It's the faintest silver lining imaginable, but it is one.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, it cuts both ways, I guess. Moderna was part of Operation Warp Speed. That is where Moderna received $2.5 billion from the U.S. to support their research. The Pfizer and BioNTech did not.
That was more the German government, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
but Trump took credit anyway.
Of course he did. Of course
he could have just waited until take credit for the Moderna one, which he would have more direct involvement in, but of course not.
Exactly. He couldn't help himself.
Right.
The other good news about the Moderna thing is one of the difficulties with the Pfizer vaccination is that it needs to be kept incredibly cold. And there's just not that many facilities and abilities to keep it that cold, particularly when you start moving into more rural areas. The Moderna apparently is much easier in that regard. It can be stable at refrigerator temperatures for a month and frozen for up to 6 months. So that's very good news. But again, we're going to have to go through a hellacious period before we get to that point. Meanwhile, here is Donald Trump. And I don't know why Donald Trump, well, I do know why he's pretending it, but I don't know why Donald Trump thinks that he has any say as to who's going to get this vaccination, because I got news for you. We're not going to see it until he's long gone. But here he is at the White House yesterday, or Friday.
Waiting for that final approval. As soon as April, the vaccine will be available to the entire general population, with the exception of places like New York State, where for political reasons, the governor decided to say, and you know, I don't think it's good politically. I think it's very bad from a health standpoint, but he wants to take his time on the vaccine. He doesn't trust where the vaccine's coming from. These are coming from the greatest companies anywhere in the world, greatest labs in the world, but he doesn't trust the fact that it's this White House, this administration. So we won't be delivering it to New York until we have authorization to do so, and that pains me to say that. This is a very successful, amazing vaccine at 90% and more. But so the Governor Cuomo, will have to let us know when he's ready for it. Otherwise, we can't be delivering it to a state that won't be giving it to its people immediately. And I know the people of New York very well. I know they want it. So the governor will let us know when he's ready. He's had some very bad editorials recently about this statement and what's happened with respect to nursing homes and his handling of nursing homes. And I hope he doesn't handle this as badly as he's handled the nursing homes. but we're ready to provide it as soon as they let us know that they'll actually use it. And again, it's a very safe and a great vaccine.
I like the idea of Cuomo just hoarding all of the vaccines.
He's going to hoard all of them. And of course, he's got some bad editorials lately. You know, Donald Trump had a bad editorial recently, too. It was one that was signed by 77 million Americans, telling him maybe next time.
And he honestly might run again next time. I am not ruling out 2024. Now that I've thought about it a little bit more, I think he's going to launch Trump TV, and that ego, it knows no bounds, and he could win the Republican primary again.
I wouldn't rule anything out, but I also think 4 years away seems like a lifetime. And,
totally.
And who knows? I mean, we are going to go through the next 3 months with the potential of getting close, at least in terms of we're going to get close, I think, by the end of this, to losing as many Americans as we did in the 1918 pandemic.
Right.
And the 17 pandemic. And it's 1918 pandemic. He kept saying 17. And I would imagine that's going to stick, but we shall see. We're going to get to Daniel in just a moment. First, from your bed to your bathroom, Brooklyn Inn has got you covered, and this holiday's no exception. Oh, you know, this might interest you. I know you're getting a new apartment soon. Brooklyn's biggest sale of the year is coming soon.
Wow.
Yes. They got great stuff for gifting. They're, you know, those people on your list, but they have a huge selection of stuff. They've got candles, they get silk eye masks, scrunchies, robes for a spa treatment type of situation. But of course, they sell some of the best towels I've ever had. And all of my sheets are Brooklyn Inn sheets. They've got two different types. They've got like the classic, and then they've got this other, I guess it's like a softer. I don't like that one. I like the classic, cool, crisp cotton ones. They've got great patterns and,
well, joke's on you. I already have Brooklyn Inn sheets.
Oh, well, boom.
But I need new towels.
Their towels are excellent.
Yeah.
They're, you know, sometimes you get like really plush towels and they don't feel like they're absorbent.
Yeah.
This is exactly the opposite. They're plush, but they're absorbent.
Oh, love it.
They're fantastic. You can cozy up to Brooklyn's biggest sale of the year, and it's coming soon, folks. Brooklyn is so confident in their product, all their sheets, their comforters, many comfort loungewear towels come with a 365-day warranty. Get huge savings and free shipping during Brooklyn's biggest sale of the year only at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to let them know our show sent you. That's brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITY. Let them know that you're over there. And if you can't wait for the sale, you're just hearing it, it's this because it's post-Black Friday or Cyber Monday, you could still use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com for 10% off and free shipping in the U.S. So make sure you use that code. Also, we're in an era where you don't want to leave your house very much, and where, you know, someone like myself with a little bit of a shut-in, it becomes a positive. Well, with stamps.com, you don't have to leave your house as much. You don't have to leave your home business as much. Anything you could do at the post office, you can do with just a few clicks. Plus, stamps.com saves you money. They have deep discounts that even the post office, you can't get at. You can use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7. Forgot to send that letter. You wake up in the middle of the night because you can't sleep. You can print out a postage. You can do it for any letter. You can do it for any package. You can do any class of mail. It doesn't matter where you're sending it, anywhere in the world. And you just schedule a pickup, or you can drop it off. Up to you. With stamps.com, you get 5 cents off of every first class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail and up to 62% off of UPS shipping rates.
Wow.
Yep. Don't spend a minute of your holiday season at the post office this year or walk into the UPS or wherever it is you go. Stamps.com. There's no risk. And with my promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. You don't have any long-term commitments. There's no contract. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Majority Report. At stamps.com, enter Majority Report. Stamps.com. You'll never have to go to the post office again. You never have to leave your house.
Love that.
Online shopping. Oh, and this is the other thing. I had mentioned earlier that I have a little bit of a sartorial challenge. Well, I no longer have that problem. I've actually got an exciting thing to say about Stitch Fix today. I mean, it's not that exciting. But you want to do some shopping? Stitch Fix can help you. Can help you both with your holiday shopping and with your own clothing shopping. Stitch Fix offers clothing that's hand-selected by expert stylists. Figure it out, your size, your style, your budget. It's a completely different and a fun way to find clothes that you're going to love to wear. You try on the pieces at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return the rest. Easy peasy. You just pay a $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited towards any pieces that you keep. There's no subscription required. You can try Stitch Fix once, or you can set up automatic deliveries, shipping, returns, exchanges, like I say, easy and totally free. Prepaid return envelope is included. Stitch Fix has styles for women, for men, for kids, and they ship all of the U.S. and available in the U.K. too. So for me, I got these Chukka boots. I don't know how to pronounce them, but they're like desert boots. I got them actually at the beginning of the year. I was very excited because they were very adult looking shoes. And then, of course, everything shuts down. I can't go out that much and show them off. But I've been kicking around in the five pocket Nashville fit pant, flag and anthem.
Yeah.
I had totally reintroduced that sort of like jean cut to me. I hadn't done that in a long time. And then I also got this, I sent back a turtleneck, a mock turtleneck. I don't do those.
You only like the sweater vest, not sweater around the neck too much.
I don't do a turtleneck. I don't do a mock turtleneck.
Yeah, well,
I don't do anything like that. But
I've
also
heard great things about Stitch Fix for it's, outside of this.
Like, I got a thermal long sleeve thing that was like sort of throwback to my days as a slacker, and I was like, I don't know about this. I'm going to keep it. Now it's like I go days. And I'm only wearing that.
Yeah.
Yes, because I'm in the house and it's perfect, particularly in this weather. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. Stitchfix.com/majority. You're going to see me in some new Stitch Fix shirts. I just, I started
some new stitches, one might say. One might call
process.
It. Okay.
All right. I'd like to welcome to the show. Do we have him? Daniel Nakanian. He is the founding editor of the political report for The Appeal. It's a project of The Appeal that covers local politics, criminal justice, mass incarceration. He, of course, also writes in the political report and sends a weekly newsletter. Daniel, welcome back to the program.
Hi, it's great to be back.
So, Daniel, let's start with this. Now, if folks remember, you were on the program, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and you were outlining for us some races that will have the most important impact on not necessarily our immigration policy, but how our immigration policy touches immigrants in this country. And it was a fascinating conversation where you know, so much we hear about policy is personnel. In this instance, it's sort of like it is the execution of policy is also a function of personnel. We're hearing a lot about the idea that there's a lot of laws on the books and the president has the opportunity to step in, choose which ones they're going to focus on and give resources to. This happens on a local level. So let's start with, and I know you've written about this, the races that you were tracking for sheriff. Mm-hmm. Remind us again why the sheriff is so important. I used to make a joke about this, but the sheriff is really, really important, particularly in the context of immigration. Why is that?
Right. You know, a lot has changed since we talked a few weeks ago on immigration, maybe more than most issues because of President Trump and Stephen Miller are on their way out of the White House. And that's definitely going to change a lot in immigration policy. But based on everything we know about President-elect Joe Biden's policies, ICE is still going to be there in the picture. ICE is still going to go after immigrants. And when it comes to ICE's ability to identify people who ICE thinks are undocumented, arrest them, kind of put them in the detention infrastructures, local law enforcement are often very, very important. Specifically, sheriff's department in a lot of places have a lot of sway over just how much local governments are going to be cooperating, either through contracts, through like actual formal on paper contracts, or through a set of informal practices. And, you know, over the past many years, it's really been a focus of organizing for immigrant rights groups around the country that have really put the focus on sheriff's offices and sheriff's elections, because these are obviously elected offices, to really put the issue of cooperation with the federal government on immigration enforcement at the center of the elections for sheriff in a way that really is new, in a way that's really a new issue in these elections. And we saw in some places again this year success for that effort.
And so give us some of the highlights, I guess, and the lowlights of that, because I'm curious both obviously for the implications of, you know, the relationships with ICE and hopefully things will change to some degree under a Biden administration, at least the posture that ICE takes. But it's also indicative of what's happening in these communities and their perspective towards this stuff, how they reacted. So where were the biggest changes in terms of those elections with the greatest implications?
Well, what's interesting is that the South, again, was the centerpiece of the setbacks that I suffered. I say again because in 2018, North Carolina really was the emblematic state where a wave of sheriffs were elected in 2018, the biggest counties in North Carolina, on promises to end contracts with ICE. And the same thing happened in some very big counties last week. I think it was last week or a couple of weeks ago. I forgot where the election is. Yeah. In Georgia and South Carolina, and specifically in Cobb and Gwinnett counties. So maybe some of our listeners have really heard of Cobb and Gwinnett recently, because they were really they're very big suburban counties in the Atlanta region that drove the success for Democrats at the top of the ticket as well. They really shifted Democratic. But that is not that the shift Democratic does not automatically translate, first of all, to Democratic gains down ballot. Also does not translate to the election of DAs or sheriffs that are running on actual reforms. Like we know from a lot of examples that Democratic sheriffs and DAs actually have cooperated with practices of the sort. But in Cobb and Gwinnett have had very longstanding aggressive policies towards their immigrant residents. The sheriff's offices in both counties have been very aggressive towards immigrants and towards contracting with ICE. And in both cases, there was really a lot of organizing by immigrant rights groups like the Asian American Advocacy Fund or Mi Gente to put these issues on the table and convince Democratic candidates to run on these issues, to promise to stop ICE contracts. And in both Cobb and Gwinnett, the Democrats flipped the offices and sheriffs are incoming who have promised to break what's called the 287G contract with ICE and other forms of ICE cooperation. And, you know, that sort of organizing, that sort of activism could translate in a couple of months into energy. Obviously, the runoffs in Georgia is what we're all going to watch right over the next 6 weeks. So it's important to not lose sight of these grassroots efforts that have also happened in Georgia.
And Daniel, just a quick question or clarifying. Can you talk about what that means tangibly for contracts to be ended with these areas in Georgia, for example? Like, what does that mean in practice?
Yeah, so the emblematic form that the organizing of contract is what's called the 287G agreement, which really is the tip of the iceberg in terms of all the forms that cooperation between sheriff's offices and ICE takes. But let's just focus on 287G, because that's what a lot of the conversation was about. 287G is a contract that effectively authorizes law enforcement at the local level to act as though they were federal agents when it comes to identifying, interrogating and arresting people who they suspect to be immigrants in within the jail space. And this is what something we talked about a month ago, Sam, which is that jails are really a space where a ton of people kind of go through, especially people of color who are likelier to be arrested. You know, it can be for any sort of low level infraction as well. You can end up being booked in jail, even if you never could convicted of a crime, even if you never end up with a criminal record, even if it's for anything really. And that under the 287G contract, those sort of low level constant routine interactions that thousands of people go through a year, those become effectively immigration checks, or places that local law enforcement can go after immigrants. And that was the focus of organizing to end that form of emblematic link between local law enforcement, which has no business running the federal government's immigration policies, to end that. And that was, you know, this is kind of obscure in the sense that it's like a bureaucratic agreement of how to deal with people in jail. The fact that it became visible enough to become covered, to become something that candidate forums were really discussing, to became something that Democratic candidates had a position on, that is none of this is obvious. I think I want to emphasize that. And it's not something that I see happening in some places where that doesn't necessarily have that level of organizing. We don't necessarily see this level of visibility for any of this. So that's really what the success is, as well as the actual result.
Was there any other races across the country where you saw something that was similar in terms of both outcome and that level of activism that raised, you know, basically forefronted an obscure agreement that really had big implications?
If we're talking about ICE specifically, you know, I talked about the South, but in places like Cincinnati in Ohio, and Athens, Georgia, and other places, the Democratic primary saw the ouster of an incumbent sheriff by a challenger who, again, was talking about ICE as an important issue. And what's interesting in Cincinnati, for instance, which is a fairly large jurisdiction at the county level, in particular, the incumbent sheriff, a Democrat, who had attended a Trump rally in the past, then endorsed the Republican in the general election against the Democratic challenger. The Democrat still won and is now going to come into office, which also is a reminder, again, of the lack of visibility to these local offices, that a sheriff in a Democratic-leaning county can attend a Trump rally. And, you know, this time was unseated, but so many sheriffs like that, so many prosecutors, so many local officials escape that level of scrutiny, escape being contested, escape the visibility. So for every story like Cincinnati, where a kind of ICE cooperating Republican-friendly Democrat was ousted in an urban area, there's a lot of examples where that level of visibility hasn't been achieved.
I'm curious about those, about Cobb and Gwinnett and Cincinnati there. I mean, do we see what happens in the other ballots in that district? In other words, like, you know, is it are the candidates who came out against ICE?
Right.
Are they like, how consistent did the Democrat win in those districts? I'm just curious, is like, you know, how telling is that race to, I guess, up ballot races?
Great question. So that will depend on the place. On Cobb and Gwinnett, Democrats did very well across the board. There was kind of a bloodbath for Republicans at the local level. In Cincinnati, that it was more mixed. The Republican prosecutor, for instance, won re-election. I could go into some of the debates in that race. So that was a more mixed. There are other sheriffs in Democratic areas, or places that when Democrats were longtime sheriffs that a Republican won, in places like Pinellas County in Florida and other places. Which is to say, again, one, that it's not obvious that the Democratic shift up ballot would translate down ballot. And two, again, it's not obvious that the issues that progressives would care about or reformers would care about would be the sort of thing that would at least be part of the conversation. So I think the success, again, is as much about the result than about the ability of reformers and organizers to inject these issues into what was overall a Democratic shift in places like Cobb and Gwinnett.
All right, so let's broaden our focus here in terms of other things that I know that you were tracking, and you had set up a site, What's on the Ballot. Mm-hmm. Take us through some of the bigger ballot measures you were watching, and maybe some of the bigger down ballot races that you were watching that you thought were pretty key, and how did the Democrats do on that accord?
Right. There is so much to go over. You know, I had 400 or so things to watch on my tracker, which you just mentioned. I think maybe one place to start is initiatives. There were a number of initiatives on the ballot that pertained to the war on drugs, to curtailing the war on drugs, to changing drug policy. And that is both interesting because of the number of ballots there were, but also because everything that was on the ballot to that effect succeeded. So perhaps the most interesting is Oregon's Measure 110, which I didn't necessarily have a clear expectation going in because there was never really a vote on a measure like that anywhere in the country, as far as I know, because Measure 110, which passed overwhelmingly 2 weeks ago, does is that it's going to decriminalize drug possession writ large. So not just possession of marijuana or certain specific, a smaller number of listed drugs, but drug possession writ large at low amounts. It is not going to legalize it. It's still going to remain a matter of law enforcement and going to be treated like an infraction, which itself raises some questions about equality of enforcement.
Right.
And so on. But it's the first state in the country that is taking this approach to drug possession. And that is important to potentially changing the conversation around the country to whether questions of substance use, questions of addiction, are a matter that the criminal legal system should be taking charge of, or whether they're a matter as to the extent that anyone's taking charge of them for other types of services, other types of systems to kind of have on their purview.
Or like
and so it could really potentially change the conversation nationwide. Yeah.
Or like a Portugal type model, something
right.
Like
that. Right. Exactly. The Oregon initiative was inspired by the Portugal model. It's like the first time that's kind of coming in to the conversation in the United States. And, you know, I don't think we should expect a lot of other states to just pass this suddenly in January. But in terms of creating somewhere in the United States that can be pointed to as doing another sort of approach to the war on drugs, that could potentially really change the conversation. Especially because what we're also seeing is a number of prosecutors win DA elections now on a similar message of saying they're not going to prosecute drug possession. They're not going to file criminal charges when it comes to drug possession. And, you know, it's not up to prosecutors to overall legalize or decriminalize anything in terms of they can't control what the police does, for one. But the message sent by a place like Austin, Texas, 2 weeks ago that elected a prosecutor that ran on that platform of saying this is really not up for the criminal legal system to take charge of. If we should fund instead more services in health, in public health, et cetera, that also sends a powerful message that kind of goes hand in hand with what happened in Oregon.
I mean, it's interesting how that topic will both sort of implicate the question of, you know, the so-called defund the police movement. Also, what's amazing to me about it is that it's an issue that has been more or less orphaned by the national parties, right? I mean, there, as far as I know, I don't think it was in the Democratic platform. I think the Republican platform was just supporting Donald Trump. So I don't think there was any actual positions in there. And I'm not being facetious about it. I think it was just our platform as we like Donald Trump. But the Democrats, I mean, I guess it's hard to know, but there was no, it won every single place in every form, any ballot measure. What were we talking, like almost a half a dozen at least?
More, yeah. So there were a lot of initiatives to leave on marijuana specifically, to legalize marijuana, and those passed both in New Jersey, which obviously is a Democratic state, in Arizona, which is a swing state that has had a punitive approach to marijuana, so definitely going to be a big deal going forward. Also passed in South Dakota and Montana by comfortable margins. I think the margin in South Dakota was 8 to 10 points, and even more so in the other three states. And you are right that no one on a presidential ticket, Joe Biden did not run on legalizing marijuana. He did not endorse that position. He definitely had some policy positions on curtailing the war on drugs and in some other ways, but he did not support the thing that passed in very red states. So there's definitely a gap there between what the national conversation is and what the state conversation is. The good news for proponents of ending the war on drugs is that states have a ton of authority, a ton of leeway in how they're going to deal with criminal charges and how they deal with how they fund services. Obviously, it's not the end of the story, but the movement we're seeing on marijuana in the four states I said, and the other states that have already done that, and in Oregon, on drug possession writ large and these DA elections, that's a huge, huge part of the story, irrespective of what the federal government does. But yeah, at some point, it's interesting to see what the gap closes.
Opportunity, it
right.
feels like.
I was going to ask, just based on, and I think I already know the answer, but based on your tracking of these ballot initiatives, if Democrats were to embrace these kinds of ideas, and now Chuck Schumer saying he's for legalizing marijuana as he faces a primary challenge in 2022, right? Like, how much do you think that would drive things down ballot when it comes to future races?
I think
races and things like that.
Right. I mean, I think you're right that a lot of Democrats have already embraced it. And in the states I mentioned, were either involved in putting it on the ballot or supportive of it. But the messaging, there's a disconnect in the messaging. It's not quite clear what the fear is of embracing something like marijuana legalization. You know, it had passed in Michigan in 2018 by about 10 points. I'd say Michigan because obviously it was on everyone's mind going into 2020 as one of the, you know, three most important swing states in terms of what the political cost or benefit of it would be. It's hard to know what. So I don't foresee that there would be a particular cost specifically on marijuana, but also on other issues. But I think what is happening, what's actually very interesting, is that candidates for county office or state office have seen this already. And just this year, the number of candidates were comfortable saying things like, we will not prosecute drug possession or other low-level behaviors like that. Was just much greater, I think, than a couple of years ago, or even before that, let alone before that. So we are seeing candidates realize that if they are interested in criminal justice reform and ending mass incarceration and everything that goes with it, they are seeing that the benefits of running on those things locally exist, and that the perceived costs of, you know, the perceived costs from the past 30, 40 years of fear of how elections are won on issues like this, that those costs are actually no longer really operative. And so that, I think, should be a sign of hope if you want change on these issues, that at the places where change could happen, there is a growing awareness of change of expectations.
I think the answer as to why you just have local people who are addressing this as opposed to national Democratic figures is a function of they still have an incentive structure and a perception of like the political terrain as if it was 1991,
or even Reagan era. Right?
Well, yeah, like, exactly. But I mean, 91 is that sort of tail end of the Reagan Bush years.
Right.
And the big door opening was Bill Clinton saying, well, I tried marijuana but I did not inhale. Oh, I just brought the joint to my lips and just made it look like I was cool and then didn't inhale. All right. So, what is, in terms of other measures that stick out, I know that we had a $15 minimum wage pass in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other big progressive agenda items that were passed, that were unlikely in some respects? I mean, in California, we saw, you know, it's almost like the mirror image of Florida in some respects, right? Florida passed the $15 minimum wage, but the Democrats get blown out. And in California, Democrats all, of course, win, but things like carving out a little part of Proposition 13 so that we can actually get legitimate property taxes from commercial enterprises there, that didn't pass. We had ballot measure number 22, which basically will have, I think, devastating impact on our labor laws across the country, but narrowly seen as carve out for, you know, Uber and Lyft and other gig economy type of things to basically misclassify their employees. It's no longer called misclassification because of that. What else did we see that we should take note of?
I think that's a great way to think about it. Just in many places, the gap between what you expect in the presidential ticket or the other results and down ballot. But what's interesting in Arizona, maybe to go along with what I was saying about Georgia, which is that the shift to Joe Biden coincided, at least in some places, with this progressive shift, right, on policies. In Arizona, what's interesting is that obviously the first time that a Democrat won a presidential election in quite some time. And what we saw at the level of ballot initiatives is, first of all, I was just saying the initiative to legalize marijuana won by about 20 points, but also Arizonans voted to increase the income tax on higher level, on higher incomes to fund the education system, to fund more teachers and better paid teachers. So that's, again, Arizona is not historically the state where you'd associate with success on a measure like this. But in fact, in recent years, it really has been a site of contestation for the Red for Ed movement, for the strikes around teachers unions, and you know, we saw that around the country, but in Arizona specifically. And this measure was linked to that, and the success, you know, it's a success of messaging around that. It's a success for progressive policies. And there again, we see kind of a contrast between Arizona voted to increase taxes specifically on higher income earners. Illinois, which is a very blue state, obviously voted for Biden by a much larger margin, voted narrowly against making its income tax progressive. At the moment, the income tax in Illinois is flat, and at least it has an income tax, which obviously is
right,
more than many places, but it's flat and would have made it progressive, and that failed. So I don't have a clear explanation for what happened in Illinois. It kind of fits the California example, where a constraint on revenue raising and progressive policymaking that has existed for a long time, the ability to change it failed. There's also obviously been a very longstanding effort in places like California by conservative interest groups or other groups to protect the legacy of Prop 13 and the anti-tax initiatives of Prop 13 from the 70s. Whereas in Arizona, there was a bipartisan, like the Red for Ed movement had a bipartisan movement. It was successful and yeah, that's an interesting disconnect.
Building on Emma's question about framing, and I will accept I don't know as an answer to this. but can we tell, you know, if Arizona went for Biden because there was a confluence of all of these different activists who were maybe pursuing the taxation, maybe coming out of the Red for Ed thing, maybe had organized because of Arpaio, the sheriff organizing that went there some years ago. I mean, and there's a greater motivation at that level when you're talking about a local issue. Like, you know, if I'm interested in a local issue, I'm going to come out and I'm going to vote on it. And then I vote up ticket. Georgia, that running against ICE in Georgia, at least in these two counties, is that reading too much into it? Is there any way for us to be able to tell? Whereas, you know, I'm going to go out, I'm going to casually vote for Joe Biden because, you know, that's what I'm going to do. I do that in California and Illinois, and I don't pay that much attention to maybe the down ballot stuff. And that stuff gets drowned out by people who are just coming in and just assuming it is what it is. And I mean, what is there any way to get a sense of that?
I think it's, and this is not the sexiest answer, but I think it's a mix of everything. I think there's obviously a lot of questions around that right now. But I think it's a mix of everything. I think people maybe also spend too much time just looking at the shift between 2016 and 2020, including in more urban areas right now where Trump maybe gained a bit, as opposed to the longer term shift in some of these places. I think you mentioned the organizing around Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County, the longtime sheriff that was ousted in 2016, which was very important to move to for political activism in Maricopa, and actually the first big win for Democrats 4 years ago in Maricopa in Arizona before 2020. So in that sense, the local the ballot visibility and Democratic gains kind of preceded the top of the ticket gains for Democrats in Arizona specifically. And in fact, this year the lieutenant of Joe Arpaio lost a comeback bid for that legacy by a bigger margin in the county than Joe Biden won it by. So that's interesting. The reservation I have about the idea that local elections are driving turnout for higher offices is just that the participation for lower for the participation for anything that isn't presidential is going to be much lower, right? And that's actually an institutional issue because so many county level, state level elections are purposefully scheduled on off year elections or off schedule elections in 2021 in April, in March, and then again people vote in November. There's actually a DA runoff in Georgia happening in December that is not on the same date as the Senate runoffs in January, which is also messed up, and the turnout that's going to have an effect on turnout. And obviously that's all a feature and not a bug. Right. So I want to keep in mind just how low participation tends to be in local elections in ways that are fixable, and that making things coincide more would be helpful to drag attention to lower ballot elections.
The only caveat I was throwing in there would just be marijuana would maybe be the one that could drive higher turnout among young people or something like that. But I don't know what the correlation is.
It also primes voters to think about things differently. Like we want, like if there's no Democrat on the ballot in a place like Cobb who is really focused on breaking ties with ICE, versus Democrat who is, because those conversations happened, those debates have happened, it's going to prime the debate a little differently. It's going to make people see the different sort of contrasts in how the parties are talking. And that's important as well, independently of the question whether they would have voted anyway, just the contrasts being clarified and the issues that these people affect being clarified.
That's really interesting. Local races as a mechanism, particularly on issues like that, as a mechanism of defining the brand, the greater brand of the Democrats and the Republicans, for that matter. Is it your sense that local races are a better measure of what the politics are of that locality, of a state houses? I mean, do you have that sense, or is that are there other factors that influence that?
I think it's gonna really just depend on the main. I think the fact that I talk so much about local elections sometimes hides the fact that there's still kind of a desperate situation where these offices are not being contested, The majority of DA elections are not contested. It's just incumbent running again. When there's, it's just the people kind of go up the ranks. Same with other offices. So I don't want to like hide that forest for the trees, where there's still so much work to be done to raise them to the level of importance that they have. What is interesting is that in so many places, in the kind of elections I really focus on, which again are criminal justice related, but this would apply to other sorts of local offices, when there is contestation and organizing and conversation around things that just haven't been part of the conversation around these offices, the expectations of who is winning or who should win or who will win these races and on what message is really being proven wrong over and over again. Like we're seeing in a bunch of suburban places, Republican candidates kind of resort, or some Democrats resort to the conventional law and order messaging. What is this person who wants to like not prosecute these type of offenses, or are they going to like increase crime? That is a very easy resort for candidates to use, because that's what we've all been taught works in elections in 30 years. And when that fails in a DA race at the local level, in a way that just really crystallizes the how wrong some of our in a suburban area, that really crystallizes how wrong some of our assumptions and expectations are, in the way that's kind of harder to make sense of at the presidential level, right? President Trump lost after month of tough on crime law and order messaging, but it's hard to tell a coherent story there. But when a place like Cincinnati has a Democratic sheriff endorsed a Republican on some like fear-mongering platform of the effects of electing this reformed Democrat, that actually tells an interesting story of the kind of work that ended up being successful, I think.
Yeah, and when that fails, you're saying
when the fear-mongering fails. Again, in many places, you know, this is not to say that every reform candidate is winning everywhere that they're running in any way, shape, or form. But I think it's the consistent story is the upending of expectations of the sort of messaging that can win, at least in.
All right, we just have very briefly. Do we? So, is the lesson from this that messaging can cut both ways, but organizing makes a big difference, or is it that the message coming out of this election is just not a coherent one?
I think that again, this shouldn't hide the significant losses at the state level for Democrats, and some of the opportunities they hoped they were going to have going into 2021. I think what people have to keep in mind when they think of what the protests are doing or what local and county level elections are, is that the level of low hanging fruit in bluer areas is just so immense that there's so much work to be done in places that at the local level vote Democratic, but in a way that hasn't integrated the conversation around these issues, that isn't owning up to the kind of things that all of these local officials can do. There's just so much space for change at the county and city level that there's just a lot of things that can change just in the type of urban and suburban areas that probably are voting Democratic at the federal and state level, but there's a lot of room there. And again, in 2021, there's going to be local races in Philly, in Pittsburgh, in New York City, where a lot of these same questions about criminal justice, but also more broadly about the future of left politics, are really going to be central to the elections in the coming 6 to 12 months.
Daniel Nikanian, founding editor of The Appeal Political Report, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Be right back in just a sec. We shall see. And also, obviously, we're going to have big problems in terms of the redistricting. I've seen some reports suggesting that at least on a congressional level, we could lose six or seven seats, as a moderate, you know, estimate, because of the failure of taking or breaking, taking state houses or breaking like a two-thirds supermajority, which will prevent, you know, vetoes of these things. But we're going to be talking about redistricting more as the weeks and months go on. Emma, I want to just play this one clip before we head into the fun half. This is, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's a revelation, but here is, as the country is on fire with COVID right now, here is the Admiral Giroir talking about the work the president has done, the engagement the president has had in this one issue.
Admiral, we know who is not shouting that message to the American public, and that is Donald Trump. The Washington Post is reporting this morning that the president has not attended a coronavirus task force meeting in at least 5 months. Is that accurate?
That's true. But the vice president does chair the coronavirus task force. The vice president, we often have several cabinet members there, and the vice president briefs the president every day or nearly every day on coronavirus. So I'm not concerned that the president doesn't attend. The vice president is there, Secretary Azar, the leadership that's there, the scientific community, Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci, myself, Dr. Hahn, Dr. Redfield. You know, we're all working, and the docs work literally every single day together. We put out over 50 million of the card-based test, another 8.5 million this week.
Admiral, I want to.
So what does he do? He hasn't spoken to Pelosi in over a year in terms of negotiating stimulus.
Don't need to.
And then the number one issue in the country, where almost 250,000 Americans are about to have died from it, but they don't count because they have pre-existing conditions, right? They're not in peak physical condition like...
Thought it was going to go away.
Right.
Thought it was November 4th, that's Easter. I was betting it was going to go away. Turned out it didn't.
Next year before the election.
Sue me.
Yeah, I mean, he seems very hands-on. That's one thing you can say about Donald Trump.
The whole administration, you just had his top COVID advisor basically say there needs to be some type of uprising in Michigan because there's an attempt by the Michigan governor to introduce some measures to mitigate the massive amount of infections that have exploded in Michigan. And the administration is doing nothing except for calling for some type of uprising. And then he backed it off. He said, I just meant vote in 2 years.
Yeah, you might want to not talk about an uprising in Michigan when there was an attempted kidnapping plot, which you then made fun of. I mean, like, that's part of when you think about these nuggets of how horrible he is. It just makes the defeat even sweeter.
All right, folks, we will see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, and we will... welcome Paul Rykoff to the show, and he will we'll have a little bit of a debate about some of these issues that we've just discussed. It's going to be we're going to have a tough time with the redistricting, and so I don't know. You know, these things are sometimes difficult to predict, but 2022 could be a real tough year for Democrats in the House. And we could easily lose the House. We'll see.
Well, if we lost seats during this time, seems pretty likely after losing all those state houses that we're primed for it. I mean, we're going to call it now and not be happy about it when it happens.
All right. Well, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder. This program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get you support the free show and you get the fun half. So check it out, jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. 7 minutes every morning, headline news for you from a leftish perspective, if you will. Also, on top of that, justcoffee.co-op. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Don't forget, Nomi Show starts on Tuesdays, youtube.com/ The Nomi Key Show. You can also find that on patreon.com/thenomakeyshow. And don't forget the Antifada, patreon.com/theantifada. Matt, what's happening on TMBS this week?
David and I did a think tank for patrons yesterday, and tomorrow it's still coming into focus, but I think what we're going to be talking about what's happening to the left in Britain and Jeremy Corbyn's ousting from Labour and the fallout from that. Patreon.com/TMBS.
All right, quick break, fun half.
In for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych.
Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. Africans. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't not us.
Come on!
Fuck. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.